Today we're going to discuss Jesus and the Jews. We last discussed the reign of Herod, the spiritual leaders around that time of Hillel and Shammai. Now, after Herod's death in 4 BCE, his kingdom essentially disintegrated. He bequeathed the chief part of his kingdom, Judea, Idumea, and Samaria, to his son Archelaus. He bequeathed the Galilee and parts of Jordan, modern-day Jordan, to his son Herod Antipas. And he bequeathed the northeastern parts of his kingdom to his son Philip. The population hoped that his death would result in a relief from taxation and changes in the methods of government, and when these demands were not met, serious riots broke out. Emperor Augustus of Rome confirmed Herod's testament, but denied Archelaus the title king. Herod was a king, but Augustus of Rome simply referred to Archelaus as an ethnarch, which is essentially a governor. Archelaus was less capable than his father, and the local population complained against him to the emperor, and so the emperor deposed him and reorganized his domain as a Roman province in 6 CE, so it's about 10 years after Herod's death, and this new domain was called Iudea. Augustus could have annexed Iudea to Syria, but Jews were a different unit than the Syrians, so they required their own separate provincial unit. Augustus could have also replaced Archelaus with another leader from Herod's successors, but he found nobody suitable, and the Jewish population in general didn't even like Herod. Eretz Yisrael was not as big as Syria, so he did not think it needed large military forces. And the governor of Iudea was called the prefect. Now, when Judea was converted into a Roman province, Yerushalayim ceased to be the administrative capital of the country. The Romans moved the governmental residence and the military headquarters to Caesarea, but Yerushalayim was still the most populated city. It was the focus of riots, clashes, and turbulent life in general, and was frequently visited by the governor. Like other provinces, Judea was required to pay tribute to Rome, and many taxes were instituted, as it was in the governor's interest to extract as much money as possible from the people. Now, criminal jurisdiction was vested in the governor based on the belief that the local courts were unsuitable for trying criminal cases. At the same time, there was some amount of Jewish self-government. Jewish institutions still had a great degree of autonomy. They were responsible for maintaining law and order, for collecting most taxes, and for supervising the Jewish population in general. The most respected of the Jewish institutions were the Sanhedrin in Yerushalayim, the Sanhedrin Gedola, the High Court, the Great Court, which had its seat by the Har HaBayis in the Lishkas HaGozi on the Temple Mount, and was the highest legal and religious authority of the Jewish nation. Jewish courts continued to exercise civil jurisdiction, and in Talmud Bavli, in Maseches Sanhedrin, Daf Mem Aleph Amud Aleph states that Arba'im Shana Kodem Churban HaBayis, about 40 years before the Beis Hamikdash was destroyed, Golsa Sanhedrin V'yashvalo B'chanus, the Sanhedrin Gedola, the High Court, the Great Court, exiled itself and from the Lishkas HaGozis, from the Temple Mount, and instead situated itself in the marketplace. And therefore what? Lo danu dide nefashas. They no longer administered or presided over capital cases. In principle, criminal jurisdiction was indeed transferred to Roman administration. In cases dealing with the desecration of the Mikdash or the temple, the Sanhedrin was entitled to pass the death sentences, though even here there was a measure of supervision by representatives of the Roman administration. The degree of supervision was liable to change according to circumstances dependent on whom the Roman governor was. And even in matters that were not in any way related to the Mikdash or to ritual, the Roman authority sometimes voluntarily authorized the Sanhedrin and the Kohen Gadol to try capital cases. The Sanhedrin consisted of either 70 or 71 members, that's a debate, and it included Kohanim Levim and even Yisraelim, even non-Kohanim and Levim. It also included Sofrim, scribes, and Chachamim, representatives of the Pharisees. And their opinion usually carried the day. The heads of the Kohuna, who were generally Tzidukim, who belonged to the Sadducean group, or they were mostly Sadducees, They rarely dared to take decisions against the express wishes of the Chachamim, who were Pharisees in the Sanhedrin. With that as the background, before we specifically speak about Jesus, it's important as background to speak about the culture of martyrdom and messianism at this time. Now, the faithfulness of the Jew to his religion reached its supreme expression in a willingness to sacrifice his life rather than transgress the commandments of the Torah. From the days of Antiochus Epiphanes, martyrological tension was the hallmark of Judaism and the other religions that it inspired. In certain circles, martyrdom became connected with messianic conceptions. The presence of martyrs was a sign that the end of days was approaching, and the belief in the messianic significance of the events served to justify the sacrifice. And messianic hopes had formed part of the Jewish heritage, even of biblical prophecy, for example, like Sefer Daniel. And soon a whole culture developed describing the apocalypse, a day of destruction that would herald the end of days. In Jewish messianism, national hopes mingled with a more universal vision. The end of days was not only the time when Israel would be purified, but it was also a time when all men and nations would be judged. It would also end the suffering of the individual, and there was a belief in the resurrection of the dead. In Sefer Daniel, there's a concept of the resurrection of the kingdom of Israel and the connection developed between the end of days and Mashiach ben David, and Mashiach from the house of David. The messianic expectation became an active factor in political life, and the entire period of the Roman governors during this time, shortly after the death of Herod, until the destruction of the second base of Hamikdash in 70 of the Common Era, was full of revolts and insurrections informed by this messianic view. Among the messianic movements at the end of the Second Temple Era was one that was to play a role of great importance in the history of the entire human race. And that, of course, was Christianity, whose origins are linked to the personality of Jesus of Nazareth. Now, Jesus was a first century Jewish preacher who lived from around 4 BCE until about 30 or 33 CE. His name comes from the Hebrew Yeshua or Yehoshua. He was born to Mary, the wife of Joseph. He was a Galilean Jew. He was from Nazareth, who was baptized by John the Baptist, a religious figure who was sentenced to death and subsequently beheaded by Herod Antipas after John rebuked him for divorcing his wife and then unlawfully wedding the wife of his brother. Jesus began his own ministry, and he gains a following as a preacher, especially to the uneducated, and he called upon the people to repent their sins and devote themselves to God. Jesus is also known as a healer. And the question that many people grapple with, especially Orthodox Jews, is how did Jesus relate to the religious leaders of the time, and how did he relate to halacha in general? Was he a from Jew, or was he a heretic? It seems that he followed halacha, and he urges his followers to follow halacha. There's something called the Sermon on the Mount in one of the early writings of the New Testament, the Gospel of Matthew, when he warns his followers to follow halacha. He says, "Think not that I am to come to destroy the law or the prophets. I have not come to destroy, but to fulfill." And he says, "Whosoever therefore shall break one of these last commandments and shall teach men so, he shall be called the least in the kingdom of heaven. But whosoever shall do and teach them, the same shall be called great in the kingdom of heaven." He tells people to follow halacha. Even though he seems to observe halacha, he may have disagreed in certain aspects with the local halacha. So, for example, there's in the book of Mark, in the Gospel of Mark, he states in the third chapter that he goes to a synagogue and there was a man with a shriveled hand, and apparently there were people who were watching him carefully to see whether Jesus would heal this person on Shabbos so they might accuse him. And he essentially tells the person to stretch out his hand, and he heals this person. And then the gospel tells us that the Pharisees went out and immediately began to conspire against him. So essentially, what this means is that he seems to have been lenient, or he didn't follow the accepted halacha when it came to some form of healing on Shabbos. He was also very strict about marriage and divorce. There is a in the Gospel of Mark, he tells someone that in the 10th chapter, whoever divorces his wife and marries another commits adultery against her. And if she divorces her husband and marries another, then she commits adultery. Now, the truth is, it could be that he generally followed the school of Shammai. In Maseches Gittin, Perek Tes, Mishnah Yud, the Mishnah tells us that Beis Shammai Omrim Lo Yigarish Adam Es Ishto Elim Kein Matzaba Dvar Erva, that a man can only divorce his wife in case of sexual misconduct, as opposed to this Beis Hillel, who says even if she burnt his cooked food. In other words, he can divorce his wife for any reason. So the Catholic ban on all divorce may represent a stricter legal standard than the one that Jesus established. Not so clear exactly, but in general, he seemed to have taken a stricter view, maybe like Shammai, maybe a little bit stricter regarding divorce. He accepts the halacha regarding the purification of mitzoraim. There's a reference in the Gospels about following the halachos of purification of mitzoraim. And we know and that he is very concerned with ethics, and he saw love of a neighbor as religion's central divine. He's very concerned with hypocrisy, and in one of the Gospels he portrays the Pharisees as impatient with outward ritual observance of minutia, which made them look acceptable and virtuous outwards, but internally they were not righteous. There is something called the woes of the Pharisees, which is a list of criticisms by Jesus that he preached against the scribes and the Pharisees. That's recorded in two of the Gospels, in Luke and Matthew. He criticizes hypocrisy, lack of justice, mercy, and lack of faithfulness to God. And he criticizes greed and murder. And by the way, the scribes or the sofrim, they had knowledge of the law and could draft halakhic documents, whereas the Pharisees were members of a party that believed in Torah Shebaal Peh and certain doctrines like resurrection of the dead. Many of them were not necessarily scribes. Now, I want to spend a few moments about Jesus' death and Jewish responsibility. So it's around Pesach in, let's say, around 30 CE, he arrives at the temple. Now, Jerusalem, during Pesach time, was a very dangerous place. The Chagim were likely times of uprisings. Pontius Pilate was the prefect at the time, and he stationed many troops in the area. Now, Jesus attracted large crowds and openly predicted the future destruction of the Beis HaMikdash and the overthrow of the temple hierarchy. He also turned over some of the tables where money was exchanged to pay the annual taxes. That evening, he leads a Pesach Seder with 12 students, and one of the students, Judas, informs on Jesus to the authorities, and while Jesus took his students to Har HaZeitim, to the Mount of Olives, he is arrested. He is accused of threatening to destroy the temple, the Mikdash, and then, according to the Gospels, the early books of the New Testament, Yosef Bar Kayapa, the Kohen Gadol, presides over a Sadducean Sanhedrin that asks Jesus if he was the Son of God. There's a debate, according to the Gospels, whether he says yes, no, or something ambiguous. Apparently, according to the Gospels, the Kohen Gadol cries blasphemy. The court says it to Pontius Pilate with the recommendation to execute him. All four Gospels suggest, either implicitly or explicitly, that because the Jews were not allowed to punish other Jews who were guilty of blasphemy, that they had to prevail upon the reluctant Romans to kill Jesus. And the Gospels, for the most part, ascribe a good character to Pilate and show him as troubled over the decision. Probably, the early church, in making inroads in the Roman Empire, did not wish its leader, the Roman leader, to be thought of as truly guilty in Roman eyes. Christianity's only hope for gaining legitimacy was to prove to Rome that its crucifixion of Jesus had been a terrible error, and had only come about when the Jews forced Pontius Pilate to do it. In the most controversial verse of all these narratives, the assembled members of the Jewish community tell Pontius Pilate, "His blood be on us and on our children," and this is the source for the Christian belief that later generations of Jews are also guilty of deicide, the crime of killing God. Pontius Pilate likely saw Jesus as a troublemaker and ordered his execution. Jesus is brought to Rome. He's crucified on the third day after his crucifixion. His tomb was found to be empty. Pontius Pilate is known to have been callous, cruel, and often engaged in executions without much thought. So the Gospel's account of Pilate's behavior is likely untrue. It should also be noted that the crucifixion itself, a Roman form of execution, was forbidden by Jewish law because it was torture. Some 50,000 to 100,000 Jews themselves were crucified by the Romans in the first century. So it's very difficult to assume that they pushed for this type of death. Crucifixion was a Roman form of execution and not a Jewish one. Additionally, it would be more logical to blame the Romans for Jesus' death because at the time the Romans were imposing harsh and brutal occupation of the land of Israel and the Jews were occasionally unruly. It's difficult to argue that Rome killed him because he and his followers were zealots that were interested in an armed rebellion against Rome. It's more likely that the Romans viewed Jesus as a threat to the peace and killed him because he was gaining followers who saw him as a messianic figure. The Jews, furthermore, lacked a motive for killing Jesus. There were many different Jewish factions that had many different disagreements with each other, but that did not lead any of the groups to arrange the execution of other allegedly heretical groups' leader. It is unlikely that they would have targeted Jesus. What's interesting, though, is that Jews themselves possibly believed that they were involved in killing Jesus. There's a Gemara in Sanhedrin, Daf Mem Gimel Amud Aleph, which was censored. It was censored during the Middle Ages, and it seems to assume that the Jews executed Jesus of Nazareth. The Gemara basically says that, the Mishnah tells us that if someone has a verdict of guilty and he's sent out to be killed, so then the town crier goes out before him and proclaims this person is going to be stoned because he committed this crime and these were the witnesses, and if anyone has any evidence to acquit him, should come forward right now. Now, the Gemara then says that essentially the crier only goes out after the verdict. And the Gemara says, but wait a second, Vatanya, don't we know, Be'erev Pesach, Tla'uhu Le'yeshu Hanotu, in Erev Pesach, they hung the corpse of Jesus, of the Notzri, the Christian, or the Nazareth, and the Hakruz Yote Lifanov Arbaim Yom, Yeshu Hanotzri Yote Lisakel, and a crier went out for him for 40 days, publicly proclaiming Jesus the Nazarene is going out to be stoned because he practiced sorcery, incited people to idolatry, and led the Jewish people astray. So the Gemara explains that this was different, that because Jesus was Karov Lamalchus, because he had ties with the government, and the Gentile authorities wanted his acquittal, so therefore the court gave him every opportunity to clear himself so that it could not be claimed that he was falsely convicted. And Dr. David Berger, who obviously is an expert on Jewish-Christian relations, he argues that in the Middle Ages, most Jews assumed that Jews executed Jesus of Nazareth based on this Talmudic passage. Although some, like Rav Adin Steinsaltz, asserted that Jesus of the Talmud is not the same as Jesus from Christianity, the founder of Christianity. Rav Steinsaltz argues that this Gemara refers to the killing of someone else who probably lived 100 or 200 years earlier, because the story of the Gemara does not match the account as it's recorded in the Gospels. And he says that Yeshu was a popular name and stories of the resurrection of the dead were in fact very common back then. It should be noted also that in Jewish folk literature, there is a popular, scandalous Jewish biography of Jesus called Toldos Yeshu, which may be as old as the 4th century of the Common Era. And in this book, in this scroll, so it describes how essentially Jesus was born because there was a woman by the name of Miriam was engaged, betrothed to a man named Yochanan from the royal house of David. And then there was this man, Joseph, who pretended to be Yochanan, and he forced himself upon Miriam, and she gave birth to a person. Again, she was betrothed to this man, so she gave birth to this illegitimate child named Yeshu. And it goes on to say how this person, Yeshu, he happened to be a healer, but he was an illegitimate child. And he said that Moshe could not have been the greatest of all prophets. And in this scroll told us Yeshu, it really mocks Jesus. And it essentially says that the Jews essentially had him killed. The responsibility for the death of Jesus is also assigned to the Jews because he was someone who was making trouble for the Jews. He was someone who was trying to lead the people astray. Again, it could be that Jews in Christian Europe may have believed for a long time that their ancestors actually killed Jesus, especially because of the level of tension that existed between these two religions. Like other messianic beliefs, Christianity developed out of the conviction that the end of days was near. But while the other messianic beliefs or messianic movements disappeared after the death or failure of their originators, this particular movement gained in power after the crucifixion of its founder and eventually transformed itself into a very powerful and popular religion.